Welcome back, everyone. This is Ryan Selkis. You're listening to another episode of Messari's Unqualified Opinions, where each week I discuss key industry trends with crypto's top investors, builders, and thinkers. Just a reminder, Messari is much more than a podcast company. So if you're an industry professional or crypto investor, head over to Messari.io and check out Messari Pro, our crypto toolkit that offers best-in-class research, advanced screening, and charting tools to keep you ahead of the investing curve, plus a new enterprise alerts tool. We're also hosting the industry's largest virtual event, the Mainnet, this June 1st through 3rd, with over 50 hours of programming, 100 confirmed speakers, and virtual networking that's so seamless, you'll feel like you're actually there. 50% of the profits are heading to COVID relief, so go reserve your spot today at mainnet.events. That's Messari.io for pro research and tools, and mainnet.events for the best virtual event you'll attend this year. With that, strap in for another episode. Going to be a good one. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refunds or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MESSARITAX and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with two Ks, tax.com, and save money this tax season. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving the 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app from merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more, with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the Crypto.com app today. This podcast is presented by Blockworks Group, one of the top blockchain events and media production companies I've worked with. For exclusive content and events that could help you with insight into the crypto and blockchain space, check them out at blockworksgroup.io and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, welcome back to Messari's Unqualified Opinions. I'm Ryan Selkis at 2BitIdiots with another suit and tie guest today, Tom Chippas. He's the CEO of ErisX. I find this very humorous because during the work from home period, Tom is clearly now in a Silicon Valley outfit when normally his clientele would expect a suit and tie, whereas I am usually in the Silicon Valley outfit and now I'm just wearing my workout clothes because fuck it. So I feel like we've both downgraded a little bit, but you're still like a level up in terms of the dress code, which I appreciate and find, you know, pretty funny. Tom, I've known you for a while. We've interacted over the course of years back when you were at Citadel, when you were at Axani, which used to be Tradeblock, now are kind of two parallel entities. And for the last couple of years, you've been working on ErisX. You've had a whole slew of announcements in terms of institutional partners over the last couple of weeks. We're going to get into all that. But for starters, let's talk about your kind of red pill story, a little bit about your background, and ultimately what in your background got you interested in blockchain technology at first, and then kind of crypto assets specifically, as you went down this path from the traditional realm into a decidedly different and much more Wild West frontier.
Yeah, thanks, Ron, and thank you for having me. You're absolutely right. I think to say initially the blockchain path, as you recall, when we first started chatting, I unabashedly was in the, let's talk about the blockchain, this crypto thing, you know, I'm not interested in this. And that was whatever it was, 2014, 2015, whenever it may have been. And for me, looking at the blockchain side of things at the time, I was falling back upon some of my experience in capital markets where trying to have multi-party processing of financial transactions that had different life cycle events that were causing inefficiencies on capital utilization, inefficiencies on risk management, inefficiencies in trade settlement. And I really saw some potential in the technology. But those early days were so crowded with wild claims and over amplified desires to change everything overnight in a capital market system that by design changes slowly, right? The appetite to change risk management and settlement processing and things like that from a regulatory perspective is slow. Well, if it's working even inefficiently, that's better than an unknown thing that may be more efficient. Let's be prudent, let's be thoughtful. And that sort of view trickles to the folks in the capital market space that process banks, clearinghouses, exchanges, what have you. But I was intrigued, started down the path, and certainly really proud of the time I spent working with the team at Axani, who I think has really done a great job pushing for the DLT story in derivatives specifically. And they've done a lot of good things there. And I think have started to prove out those early day assumptions I had about the potential for this technology to improve things like CDS processing and equity swaps processing and other use cases. Mm-hmm. From there, for me, certainly being at Axani, where, as you point out, there were two businesses, Trayblock, which is really, you know, market data, indices, OMS, EMS, these sorts of things within the crypto space. And then separately, the DLT company. I was very focused on the Axani side, but always with a sort of eye over my shoulder looking at what's going on with Trayblock. And the trader in me just was constantly intrigued at the market structure, the way the markets were operating at a physical level, the lack of interconnectivity, the volatility, all sorts of things that were very different than equities, options, futures, rates, what have you, things that I was more familiar with. Mm-hmm. So it was in the back of my mind. And I would say, you know, on my own time, on my own homework, I kept looking at crypto markets and starting to get involved personally. And then just as the rest of the maturation process started to move from that period to now, and obviously explosive growth in non-US exchanges, US exchanges, the various understanding of the economic impact of something like a non-sovereign store of value could have. And for me, just keeping a constant eye on it, I reached an apogee where when the opportunity for RSX came, just was the only thing I could see myself doing, because it is truly an intersection of market structure, an opportunity to build something different and do it in the crypto space. So I'm now passively watching DLT and more focused, obviously, on the crypto side of things, but unabashedly started on the DLT side before getting to where I'm at today.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the institutional landscape, because there's I'd say three core things, but fill in the gaps here for a more nuanced understanding. There's three core things that have prevented institutional purchasing. And the first step in the on-ramp historically. One has been data integrity, which not only impacts compliance teams in terms of how they're thinking about market to market, but much more importantly, makes it difficult to prove that a trade was executed at the best bidder offer, right? So data integrity and is probably number one, which trickles upstream to the exchanges that are actually providing that data. The second is institutional custody. And just how a money manager can get their legal teams comfortable with actually making a purchase that isn't just going to evaporate via some type of hack, right? And then the third is on the regulatory side. So, in the U.S. and most of the Western economies, for the most part, that's been, you could argue largely solved, at least for Bitcoin, but other assets, are going to be a slow and steady process to get institutions comfortable. In reality, it doesn't really matter, because the first step is almost always Bitcoin if you're talking about institutional allocations. Beyond that, there's a whole slew of tools that need to be built in reality to actually smooth that user experience for a large asset manager or a large bank or hedge fund. And we're just starting to see, products like ErisX, like what Bakkt is building, like Fidelity, come to market that are adequately satisfying this niche. And I say niche, maybe like in air quotes, because I think we all know that it should be the biggest driver of long-term value and growth. And ultimately that'll have a trickle down effect on the rest of the industry, just given the enormous amount of money that has been sitting on the sidelines historically. What are some of the critical things that you are tackling and the pieces of that puzzle that are internal at Arisex versus what are you leaving up to your partners and how do you put this jigsaw puzzle together when you try to come up with a full stack alternative to what these investors would expect from a legacy asset class versus this new novel asset class that presents a few challenges where, you know, liquidity is pooled in unregulated exchanges, you know, custody is not a solved problem yet. And you know, things move 24/7. So you don't have the same capacity to, you know, enforce some traditional regulatory structures. You cover a few pieces of that, but I'm curious what is fully in-house versus what you work with other partners on.
Yeah, I think actually your last comment, Ryan, regarding there's different pieces in this chain are really the important ones. And certainly, you know, from day one for ArisX, it's been about providing very specific services in a very specific way under very specific regulatory regimes. And all that specificity comes together in that we are an exchange and a clearinghouse. We're not a broker dealer. We're not an asset manager. Mm-hmm. We're not a proprietary trading desk. We're not an agency trading desk. If you look at traditional asset classes, take equities, for example, you know, your broker, whether you're retail and you're someone like TD Ameritrade or TradeStation or E-Trade or what have you, Fidelity, or if you're institutional and you trade through UBS, Deutsche Bank, JP Morgan, and Citi, you're dealing with a broker. You and I as individuals and investment managers that run mutual funds are not members, are not participants directly in an exchange. They go through intermediaries. And that's because there's different roles to be played. And those different roles manage different aspects of risk, transaction processing, and are regulated differently as well, too. That hasn't been the case in crypto, right? Complete and total vertical integration has been the business model from early days. And I think that works to some extent in retail, but there's also some things that don't work in that model. And I could take you through some of those pieces. I mean, addressing some of your comments directly, for example, around data integrity, you know, the concept of getting the best price, the concept of best execution, certainly mm-hmm. something that exists under regulation in the US today for things like equities. And by and large, it works exceedingly well. You're going to get probably the best possible price. There's an argument in equity spheres about price discovery and how prices are displayed. But by and large, if you compare how people do today versus how they did previous to regulation NMS going live back in 2007, it's far superior today than it is. And then you have similar things in Western Europe that came about under MiFID and MiFID II and other regulations that were put in place there. It doesn't matter in other markets where you have monopoly equities exchanges. There's only one place to trade. You're going to get the price that's on that particular market. There's a different argument for what best is, but you're not dealing with, hey, there's 10 different places with a quote. Who's got the best quote, the most depth, et cetera. Futures in the U.S. only trade on one exchange. You can't trade an S&P 500 future anywhere other than the CME. So mm-hmm. BestX, again, takes place on one market, not multiple. So the whole data integrity issue, I think, is an interesting one, because if Bitcoin, for example, is being looked at OTC venues versus exchanges, that tends to look a little bit more like what you have in FX today, where you have OTC providers of FX liquidity, and you have pooled market centers. They're not exchanges, but they're market centers where some sort of matching engine is offering bids and offers for you to interact with as well, too. There's no law that says you have to get BestX on your U.S. dollar, you know, sterling pair. Mm-hmm. There's tools, and there's entities that provide those tools that help you make the judgment as to whether or not you've gotten the best possible execution, which, by the way, doesn't always mean the best possible price. There are other aspects to execution. Size, risk, market impact, these sorts of things. So the data integrity issue, I think, is maturing in the sense that there are different venues and there are people providing tools for multi-venue access. It tends to come up more when we're talking about the creation of investment vehicles, ETF, a mutual fund, et cetera. That's where this tends to come up. And I firmly believe that there is ample data that can be utilized to prove the sufficiency of the prices those funds receive. Is it done under a perfect regime as you have, say, in the U.S. in equities? And, you know, perfect, of course, I'm not saying perfectly perfect, but one that's well-monitored, robust, and mature, no, it doesn't operate that way. But there's also 24/7 liquidity with a plethora of prices and venues that can provide it, where market manipulation, if that's your concern, I think it can be seen and the impact of it can be mitigated. And I think there's plenty of studies that have already been done to indicate there's high degrees of integrity in the data that could be used for the purposes of pricing some sort of pooled investment vehicle. So I think that one's come along pretty well, actually, in my opinion.
How do you do the risk scoring for international exchanges then, right? So we have our real 10 volumes. And we've struggled with this for a while because this reflects the Bitwise exchange exchanges that have made it, you know, that have passed muster according to this very rigorous study that they did, and they've kept updated. We know it's woefully incomplete and are actively working on updates to that real volume metric that will be more accurate if less precise, if that makes sense. And the reason is everybody knows that price discovery is happening on BitMEX, on Wobi, on Binance International, and OKX, right? And then, you know, maybe to a lesser extent, some of the other futures exchanges as well. At the same time, you know, the Real 10 exchange is very Western focused. So it kind of, it ignores the very real liquidity and where you could argue the lion's share of price discovery is happening. The day-to-day price doesn't change that much depending on which constituents you use one way or the other. But from an institutional purchaser standpoint, you're talking about two separate things. You're talking about the structured financial products, and then you're talking about just getting institution coverage. So when you think about the risk of best execution for a new client, what are the rules that you have in place in terms of data inputs or different exchanges that you can connect to? Or do you need to basically create a layer of abstraction between the less regulated Wild West international exchanges and maybe like an OTC desk that will do business with them, but is regulated in the US. So you've basically pushed all of that regulatory risk onto a third party that kind of sits somewhere in the middle. How does this play out in practice?
Yeah, I think there is a couple of points that I think about as well, too. So first and foremost, as an exchange, we're not routing to other exchanges. We don't have interconnectivity today. And most of the ones in the Western space do not. It's an interesting argument as to whether or not that should come from an exchange or come from a third-party provider. Certainly in equities, the exchanges provide routing. There's also a third-party that provide routing. And I like the idea of having multiple solutions so customers and market participants can pick what will work best for them. Mm-hmm. With respect to where price discovery takes place, you know, if Bitcoin's a commodity, if Ether's a commodity, we certainly believe they are, typical commodities have their price set in the futures market. That's the delivery price for the commodity. But I think we have such a deep and robust and liquid spot market, that sort of market dynamic hasn't fully matured yet with respect to the derivative setting the delivery price, as it does for hard commodities today. Mm-hmm. So with that being stated, you're absolutely right. There's substantial price discovery taking place on the, you know, non-US, unlightly or however you want to describe the regulatory status of some of those entities. That is undeniably happening. The volume is there and price discovery is taking place there. But my earlier comment about integrity comes from the fact that you can only, if you're going to engage in manipulative activity, you can only engage in it so far for so long until it actually creates an opportunity for somebody else to trade at what they think is a better price. Maybe not at that point in time, but they're saying, look, you've suppressed it so far. Once this unnatural suppression, which will cost this bad actor so much money to sustain, then, hey, I could have picked up this asset cheap somewhere else where I have high degrees of integrity and wait for that price to go up. Now, that's not helpful if you're just trying to get in today and buy some Bitcoin right now. You want to get the best possible price right now. But my earlier comment about the number of venues, and I would agree with your comment that price generally is very tightly clustered, tells me that there's only so much that can happen in a market where someone is trying to do something bad. And it's because there are so many other places to trade that it creates that arbitrage I described. And that's a good natural suppression mechanism. Multiple venues with different players trading at different time horizons and for different purposes helps collapse down that arbitrage. So if we were winding the clock back several years ago, and you didn't have fully professional market making firms, you know, like Cumberland and Susquehanna and Flow Traders and Virtu and people like this involved in the markets, I'd be pretty worried. But the more involvement you get from entities like that, that malpricing, for whatever reason, might be taking place on venue X, is an opportunity to capture arbitrage because of the price on venue, you know, A through Z, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the more you see those players come in, the more confident I become that no matter what the mal reason might be for, it doesn't matter. It's an arbitrage opportunity, and then those things will be collapsed down. That market solution is the best one I can think of. With that said, some of the third-party providers of technology that purport to route across different venues do have algorithms that, let's call it, provide a score. I'm not saying this is their term, but they score the court, and they look at it for its integrity and depth, and how many times do I send an order for a quote that's displayed? Do I actually get it? That hit rate, that fulfillment rate, says a lot about whether or not it's a real quote or was someone just flashing it there and then pulling it at the last second. So, you know, very low fill rates would be an indicator of there being some sort of problem in the liquidity stack of that particular venue. You also have to look at the difficulty of routing across the different venues because the fee tables are all so very, very different. So do you want the best display price? Do you want the best display price modified by the fee? Do you want the best display price modified by the fee, but also with some takedown for the displayed quantity because our hit rate is so low, we don't think we'll get the whole thing. We don't want to pollute our artificial top of book. There's lots of factors. There's more mental and physical horsepower that can be employed in these things than we can even dream of. And the fact of the matter is these tools exist today. They're not widely used yet, but I think their usage is coming up. So we would view ourselves as a member of the market structure where our quote is being provided perhaps to one of those utilities so that we could be hit and lifted as people are searching the quote. With that said, I don't know that top of book best price is the only factor for best execution today. We're not trading a share of Amazon. We're talking about something that has different characteristics. So the underlying integrity of the market center, the counterparty worthiness, the counterparty risk assessment, what's the value of coming to somewhere like ErisX with a regulated clearinghouse that's distinct from the exchange, that holds cash, that holds collateral, that has value. And if our quote might not always be the inside, then the investor, the market participant, the trader is going to have to decide, well, do I just care about the price or do I want to take counterparty risk into my calculus? And I'll tell you, as a longtime market participant, everyone talks about counterparty risk. No one cares about it until they care about it. And when they care, it's usually because something very, very bad is happening. Most institutions think about this a priori. They think about it before they get involved. Most retail or semi-pros that came up through retail, they'll just say, look, I traded today, I got it, I'm done. That's great. But if I'm running a large mutual fund where I'm regulated myself as an investment manager, I have to think about counterparty risk and integrity, and that comes into my best X analysis.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refunds or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MessariTax and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with two Ks, tax.com and save money this tax season. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving the 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app for merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the Crypto.com app today. I mean, where are volumes for ErisX in the context of the broader market? Because to my knowledge, at least we're not familiar with any, you know, accessible endpoints you have to understand, you know, just how much liquidity is available in your on your spot exchange or your futures market. You know, you've unveiled a few new offerings. You've got a ton of large customers, but you don't see ErisX on like the Coin Market Cap, Crypto Compare, or you know, Messari rankings. Is that something that will change, or is there a method to the madness there? And is that intentional to maintain client privacy or just trade secrets?
A little column A, a little column B. yes, we're not on any of those services today. Our market's growing, Ryan. The numbers are relatively modest right now. And, you know, to be candid, the view in crypto still tends to be, hey, it's not a roaring success overnight. You failed. And that's not what we're trying to achieve here. So our customer privacy, and you know, we're under no obligation to disclose the spot market volumes, but obviously it's a common practice. I don't deny that. So I'd suggest that right now it's, you know, modest and growing. We've just started to turn on some of these intermediaries. The market takes time to mature. When you're growing it fully naturally like we are, we're not paying anyone to make liquidity. We don't have an in-house market maker. We don't have an affiliate that's making markets. We've done none of those things today. And growing it naturally is a little bit different than perhaps some of the methods utilized in other exchanges to have their volume look better. So not displayed out there today, modest and growing. I would expect that to change later where we can do it in a way that won't betray the anonymity of what's going on.
It's interesting that you position it like this. So first of all, I agree, given your target demographic. And I think what people generally don't understand in an otherwise retail-driven market is there are some headlines and partnership announcements that are made that don't mean a fucking thing. And then there are data sets that are unavailable that either mean a lot or mean next to nothing. But I think that you have to kind of put everything in a 2x2 matrix. And when you're talking about institutional tools, the headlines matter a lot more if they're actual trading integrations versus, you know, exploratory calls and kind of jumping the gun. So you can envision plenty of scenarios where, you know, having TradeStation, having Fidelity, having some of these other large partners that you guys have onboarded really just in the last couple of months as being the critical, you know, first step in going from, you know, zero to one of the most liquid exchanges in the West and you know, maybe, you know, beyond that after a certain period of time. But because there is no internal market maker, because you have to do the hard work of actually letting this infrastructure develop and these markets develop organically, how do you get to that point, right? Because liquidity begets liquidity. Everybody knows the issues with BitMEX. Doesn't matter, right? It's still the most liquid place to buy and sell Bitcoin globally. Bitfinex, same thing. You know you've got issues with Tether. You know that you've had a history of a couple of different hacks and vulnerabilities. Doesn't matter. They've got staying power. You know that's where liquidity is concentrated. For long tail assets, you can say the same thing maybe about Binance. And the trick historically for investors has been, how can I get my compliance team comfortable with going to where the liquidity is? The approach that you and I think your clients are taking necessarily, given how much more heavily regulated they are, has to be, this is not a walled garden, but it's probably the safest place that you're going to be able to participate. But now we need to find the liquidity. Now we need to be, you know, kind of organically bootstrap the central limit order book. So that this is attractive, and you know, right now you're at kind of a diametrically opposite side of you know, this liquidity compliance matrix. I'm curious what tangible steps, without naming names, have to happen to close the gap, even begin to close the gap, because there's a big difference between modest, which is, hey, the system works and customers are comfortable, and actually being a, frankly, an exchange that matters in the global scheme of crypto.
Yeah, well, I think first thing I'd say is we're talking about spot. Futures is a completely different kettle of fish, and especially when you're talking about it in the U.S. But with respect to how does it grow, we are doing a number of things. First and foremost, market makers will go where the liquidity is. So as liquidity increases or demand on our book increases, market makers can step up and provide more liquidity. That's very straightforward for them and very clear for them. And they trade where there's trading to be done. So I'm not as concerned about the liquidity provisioning side of things. It is on the demand side, and different than an exchange that is exclusively going to retail direct. And again, we do offer direct retail as well, but focus on the intermediaries, which is where we see the growth coming from. You need a couple things to happen. So things like our announcement over the last week with TradeStation and Fidelity are first steps. They're not the last step. They're the first step. There needs to be education for their customers. They need to think about their asset allocation models. They need to think about the services they're offering their clients. And we work with them to make sure that our services are complementary and accretive and additive in those regards. But what would it mean for registered investment advisors to start suggesting to their clients of, say, medium to high risk tolerance, that you should have 1% of your assets in Bitcoin? That would be a substantial amount of flow that has to come in. And for that to come in, it's not going to go in through an account at BitMEX or Deribit, and it's probably not going to go in to an account at one of the Western or US known crypto exchanges as well, too, because they don't have the methods, the systems, and the appropriate means to manage that sort of flow. It's a very different workflow. It's a very different type of processing. But what it means is over time is those sorts of fundamental changes start to take place. We do start to be the beneficiary of it, and that starts to grow the demand side of our book. In addition, we are working with miners and other folks in the commodity producer chain that we think will benefit from a model where we have both a spot market and a derivatives market. It starts to look a lot more akin to how commodity producers interact at places like CME or ICE or what have you with hard commodities, where, hey, I'm a producer, I have a bunch of costs and inputs that go into the creation or extraction or refinement of this commodity. And it would be great if I could have something better than a guess at what the spot price will be when I have the commodity. I'd like to be able to sell it now and then deliver it later. And you can't do that if all you have is a derivative, because ultimately they're going to either have the commodity itself to use as collateral, so they need to bring that spot inventory in, and or they're going to want to trade between the two as the market still is imperfect and maturing. So from our perspective, it's just whittling away every day at bringing on that other side of the book and continuing to build good, strong relationships with the world-class market makers we have who can provide more and more of that liquidity. So it's certainly not, bang, zoom, fireworks. It's definitely a lot more of slow, boring grinding. And, maybe we're just gluttons for punishment, but it works well for us.
Well, I mean, it's just like anything else, right? You can rapidly iterate and you can make very, very quick progress if you're talking about, retail or where you're talking about, hobbyists that are going to have a higher tolerance. It's much, much more difficult to actually get this done at institutional grade because you're talking about, oil tankers turning around in the middle of a storm, particularly right now, right? I mean, that's literally, you're trying to get attention and kind of get internal resources, some of these big markets or big institutional players at a time when the global markets in general are in turmoil. And you could argue, crypto had a pretty particularly high profile black eye, not just because of Black Thursday and the price action, but because of how it went down and how prices were dragged lower based on this cascading issue at BitMEX, allegedly or almost certainly at this point. I don't want to get into trouble, but I think everybody knows what happened. I'm curious, how has the narrative changed? How has the momentum changed at all so far this year? Because some of what you've announced is the result of years of work with some of these partners, because that's what the cycle looks like. I'm curious what type of disruption you have in the middle of the customer development funnel now that a lot of these teams are distracted and maybe there's slightly less urgency to move forward with crypto, given all the other competing priorities and the tumults of the broader macro markets more recently.
Yeah, getting mind share is always tougher now. I'd agree with that. I'd say it's not our customer base isn't homogeneous, so the answers don't universally apply to everybody.
Mm-hmm. But in a very let's break them down. Yeah. I mean, how would you segment the professional market right now and kind of where we are in the maturity curve?
Yeah, so we look at people like market makers who are trading typically for their own book. someone like Virtu is a publicly traded company, but you look at market makers, and just I'm using names that people will be familiar with. I'm certainly buying that people aren't doing fun things on our market, but you have market makers like a Virtu, a Cumberland, a Susquehanna, a Flow Traders, what have you, fully professional. They haven't skipped a beat. They're trading, managing risk every single day. You have professional trading firms that look a lot like market makers. The difference in our market is a market maker has signed up for a market making program, and there's metrics around how they trade, and that impacts the rate card and things of that nature. You have intermediaries, and intermediaries can be of different flavors. So they can be a TradeStation, a Fidelity, a TD Ameritrade, an E-Trade, someone like this. Or they can be an institutional intermediary, someone like an EDF Man or other futures commission merchants that intermediate on behalf of institutions. And then we have asset managers, and those asset managers can be organized in a traditional way. Maybe they operate a some sort of regulated 40 Act fund, or perhaps organized more as a hedge fund. And then you have the direct to retail as well, to where two-legged carbon-based life forms sign up for an account. So that's how we break it down. Two-legged people, I think, have time on their hands and interest to trade, and they continue to do so. Market makers, as I said, managing risk, professional trading shops, same thing. It's in that intermediary space, I'd say, where we experienced a little bit of a, it's wrong to call it a slowdown. I mean, we're going through something that no one that's alive has ever experienced before. So reasonably so, people are dealing with personal issues, professional issues, et cetera. But by and large, I'd say after a couple weeks of universal work from home was in place, things got back on track. And I would argue that in some instances, being at home, just pounding away at the inbox has seemed to benefit us in some cases as well too. You know, we've had the Fidelity announcement and TradeStation announcement, both the things you rightly point out have been in the works for a while. Those things take time because of the nature of what we're doing, and we're all regulated entities and working through a variety of priorities. We have some other things that we think will be very interesting coming out soon. But all of them are a function of us just never letting the momentum stop. You know, the thing I always say to our business development team, our product team, et cetera, is look, I wish every day could be peak efficiency. It would be wonderful if we were just operating at that peak efficiency with the movement of customers every single day. But we're not the only input to that equation. Customer is a massive input to that equation. And some days they're going to give you everything. Some days they might give you very little. But our goal is to make sure that at least every day the forward momentum doesn't stop. I want max momentum. But I'm a realist, and the folks we're dealing with aren't always going to have us as their number one priority. So our goal is to make sure that at least we don't come to a standstill. At least we're always moving forward. So I would say that we're firing all cylinders at this point. I would say that our target market, our market participants are as well too. And people have adjusted themselves to this environment. But I don't want to name names, but in some places, I honestly truly think being home has helped move things faster, fewer distractions. And I think also, if you look at the retail intermediary side of things, and this is a macro comment, not a comment on any one particular participant, let's look at what's happened over the last 6 months or so. Robinhood was going to take over the world. Everyone was going to $0. Then that party was joined by other people, SoFi and Square and others. And you know that drove a massive upheaval in the market, acquisition and M&A, reducing fees to zero. And then several months later, we have this massive spike in market volatility and a ton of trading volume, all of which is being charged $0 of commission. And then interest rates are dropping. And that's really where those retail intermediaries were making a lot of their profits, were out of banking those cash holdings and generating interest income on it. So I think it's a very challenging time
for and they also assumed that their systems wouldn't break at the most important hour.
I mean, for the most part, I think some fared better than others. You know, again, it's one of those things, Ryan, where no one thinks about counterparty worthiness until it's a problem. And people are usually only noticing it's a problem when it's already on fire. No one gets patted on the head for saying, hey, I opened the door to the fridge and the beer was cold. No one notices it's warm. So I would say, by and large, the challenges faced by the retail intermediaries have been truly unique. I can't point to any time in history where they've had this confluence of challenges, and they've all performed admirably. Doesn't mean flawlessly. You point out some did have issues, but I think it's just been fascinating to watch the new business model proffered by Robinhood and others, and then some of the folks that have sort of joined the bid on that business model who have perhaps, you know, deeper history on operations. And all these things are coming together in interesting ways, and I think people are going to choose their provider. But ultimately, all of them have, I think, with great integrity, continue to move forward. I can't point to anyone that we're talking to that has simply put their heads down and said, leave me alone. We have to wait for this to blow over. I think everyone recognizes that although the new normal is unknown, it's not going away anytime soon. So we need to continue to make forward progress. And that's part of the way we try to engage. It's why I'm always telling my team, momentum every day, sometimes fast, sometimes slow. But overall, I'd say nothing's holding us up now because of the lockdowns or what have you. We're fully engaged. And it's really great to see the people that were in outreach with fully engaged as well.
Mm-hmm. I guess what do you expect for the remainder of the year, both with ErisX and then in terms of ongoing changes in the broader global exchange landscape? Do you expect the spot markets to continue to develop at the same pace as the futures market? It seems like we've kind of gone all the way in the other direction, at least for a while, in over-levering crypto trading. And now there's been a deleveraging because of the flight to liquidity in general, but particularly fear about some of the counterparty risk. And how do you at ErisX view the opportunities there in spot versus futures?
Yeah, I mean, for us, we started with spot, and the spot underpins our physically delivered futures. So we have to have that, and we'll continue to support that. There isn't some magic feature that we could build on our spot market today that would bring all these other people into it. I think we have a robust market with a very deep feature set, some of the best technology out there today built by markets professionals for volume, throughput, low standard deviation of performance. We built a brand new clearing system from scratch. No one's built a brand new derivatives and spot clearing system from scratch since we were texting about having to go 111-222-333. Mm-hmm. Right? It's been a while. So we built some great technology, and that's nice. No one pays us to do that. It's something we need to do, but it's nice to know that the team has gone about and done it in the right way. But with that strong foundation, modern technology, very flexible, we have a very good spot market foundation that will continue to grow. And I think spot market volumes will continue to grow. I don't think it's going to be meteoric growth. I think it's going to be steady growth. Despite the negative consequences you've observed in some non-US derivatives markets, I think there's a ton of headroom for growth in US derivatives. If you look at the landscape today, there's very little choice for people. We have a moderately sized Bitcoin, physically delivered Bitcoin futures contract as a tenth of Bitcoin. That's very retail friendly. We have other futures in the pipeline. But if I were to summarize our focus for the rest of the year, it's on derivatives that are going to be appealing to the retail market. We think that the U.S. market today has a lot of pent-up interest in this. There are a lot of very seasoned, very savvy professional traders that want to trade these products, but don't want to do it offshore. They like the integrity of what the CFTC framework provides from the derivatives perspective. And they don't need 125x to trade. They'd be happy with a much more moderate amount of margin being made available to them. So our futures products today are fully funded. Margin can be achieved, or leverage can be achieved, by going through an intermediary who can do it through other means. Natively in our clearinghouse, we don't offer it yet. That's on a roadmap for this year. There's technology, there's risk, there's regulatory things that have to be done before we can offer that. That is firmly on our roadmap for this year. We also think access products that are unique and give people the opportunity to trade around some of the volatility that's in the market today, that removes some of the frictions of delivery that exist today, will be interesting as well. So we'll have more to say on that with the product we have in the pipeline right now. So short strokes, we continue to support our spot market. We think we have a very robust platform. It's grinding out with all the market participants we want on board to make sure they have what they need, and they're ticking all the regulatory boxes, custody boxes, et cetera. But really, for us, the majority of our product and engineering effort will be focused on derivatives that are appealing to the retail market.
Awesome. Tom, I think it's certainly been exciting to watch this play out over the course of the last really couple of years, and see so many of these projects come to fruition and come public. and really just the last few weeks, kind of in the midst of the pandemic. So it certainly looks like you've been hammering away at the inbox. And I'm curious for folks that are trying to learn more about ErisX, or, you know, otherwise, you know, get involved or consider, actually integrating with the platform, how can they, learn more and get over this hurdle of understanding exactly what's getting built on the inside, since you tend to keep a lower profile than some of the other exchanges?
Yes. We're the opposite ends of the Twitter spectrum, Ryan. But obviously ErisX.com, ErisX Digital on Twitter, ErisX Insights on Medium. So ErisX.com has all the links. That's the best place to start. I think you've probably seen we're very active on market structure pieces. We put a lot of thought into topics, whether it's things like the RFI response we filed last year with respect to Ethereum. We've written about simple limit order books versus OTC markets. So we tend to spend a lot of time thinking, and there's a lot of pieces out there on Medium we've written if you're looking to get a flavor for how we see the markets and see the world. But any of those channels, you can hit us up and we'll be able to respond in kind.
Are you mostly focused on Western markets? Is there any Eastern presence at this point?
We have customers from Asia today, without mm-hmm. doubt. Like, obviously, we have the MSB MTL regulatory construct pretty well in hand here in the US. We have our CFTC license operating exchange called the DCM, and the CFTC license operate clearinghouse called DCO. And there's not that many DCOs out there, by the way. It's a pretty difficult license to get. With that, we can pursue customers here in the US, but we can also bring in customers from certain places outside the US as well too. So we're not onboarding or going after, two-legged people in non-US countries, but entities that are organized professionally in some sort of corporate form. We definitely have those on board already from places like Singapore, Hong Kong, UK, Western Europe, et cetera. So we're not trying to go head-to-head from a product perspective in those markets, because it's very difficult to operate in a highly regulated constructs we have here in the US. The regulator knows where to find me if they want me. I don't mm-hmm. think that applies to everyone operating exchanges elsewhere. So we're not trying to compete in an unlevel playing field there, but we do have customers on the platform today from outside the US where we have the appropriate, reciprocity with those jurisdictions to be able to do that.
Awesome. Well, Tom, thanks again for joining. The work that is less sexy, but ultimately the only thing that really matters in terms of number go up, if you're talking about any type of demand shift in the positive direction, which obviously has a trickle down effect on the rest of the industry. So thanks for joining and congrats on all the recent milestones that have been long in the works, but finally announced. And for everybody watching or listening, or getting this via messenger pigeon, however you are handling the pandemic, thanks for tuning in. And we'll have another episode in just a couple of days. Till next time, though, thank you. Stay safe. Peace.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. New episodes of Unqualified Opinions go live weekdays at noon Eastern Time. You can follow me in the meantime on Twitter at 2BitIdiot. If you want to continue the conversation or troll me. Otherwise, I'll see you next week.